I Hate Politics is a podcast dedicated to exploring a human activity we love to hate. We look at human life, culture, economics closest to us, in our neighborhoods, workplaces, schools and streets, and in our local governments. Together, we'll explore how politics is central to getting things done in societies where we treasure diverse views and preferences. I'm Sunil Dasgupta. I've spent my life studying politics, and I know this. Unless we want to live in a dictatorship or a monarchy, we are stuck with politics. Politics is more than just Trump, Biden, or elections. It's how we fix potholes, make our streets safer, where we put our schools, and decide who goes to them. It's about coming together as a community. It's about us. Let's go find those stories. January 21st, 2021 was a happy day for many, but it was special in our very small politics way for communities along Southern Georgia Avenue in Montgomery County, Maryland. It was also the day these communities found out that the Maryland Department of Transportation had agreed to provide $1.6 million for a redesign of the streetscape along Georgia Avenue from about Forest Glen Metro to 16th Street, which is just south of I-495, the Capitol Beltway. $1.6 million is a lot of money for you and me, but in government money, it is not a lot. And yet, this is the story, small in its origins, but big in its significance that excites and energizes the podcast. And I hope it brings home to you the ubiquity and indeed the necessity of politics in bringing about change in our communities. In just a minute, I'll be joined by Michelle Foster, a green homes expert and president of the Friends of Forest Glen and Montgomery Hills, a civic association that has led the effort to bring about the Georgia Avenue redesign. And Pratap Verma, who's also a Forest Glen resident, fighting alongside Michelle on this project for many years. And he now sits on the Montgomery County Planning Board. I'll be joined as well by Melissa Williams, who works for the Montgomery County Planning Department and has led the county government's effort called sector planning that laid the basis for the redesign of Southern Georgia Avenue. But first, the news roundup. Big news in the vaccine woes. If you live in the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area, vaccine distribution has been varied. It seems that D.C. and Virginia are doing better than Maryland, and in Maryland, Montgomery County. The county government, working through its Health and Human Services Department, for example, has been refusing to vaccinate teachers, though this may change soon. Meanwhile, hospitals which are following the state's priority listing, which is different from the county priority listing, have been vaccinating teachers since January 25th, leading to a situation which some people are calling vaccine hunger games. The major county hospitals, Holy Cross, Adventist, Suburban, and Johns Hopkins, have separate lists and alerts that people must sign on. But their appointments disappear within 15, 20 minutes of opening up. It's very hard to get. Older folks who need a vaccine remain unvaccinated, and teachers who might need to go back to school buildings in March are hunting down vaccines where they can get them. There's even a group of volunteers trying to help older residents get the shots. They call themselves Vaccine Hunters, and you can find them on Facebook. The county has complained that the state under Governor Hogan is not sending enough vaccines to the county government, while the state counts all the county hospitals in the county's share of vaccines. Because the county government and the hospitals have not come up with a joint plan, the vaccination effort remains really uncoordinated. The Brookings Institution, the Washington think tank, compared Maryland's failure to West Virginia's successes. West Virginia has a smaller population, no doubt. The big difference between the two states seems to be a statewide coordinated approach and an effort in West Virginia to pre-identify vaccine candidates. We'll be watching this very closely. And Fairfax County Public Schools went back to school for some in-person classes in early February. Montgomery County Public Schools is in the throes of pitch battle between reopeners and closers, with competing petitions, school board testimonies, Facebook posts, and what have you. If you want to see politics at work closest to home, observe closely. Even though everyone who wants to win this argument claims to hold the truth and stand above politics. Maryland Governor Hogan and others have decried teachers' unions as standing against the best interests of children. Most surveys, many of them quite imperfect, show that closers have a 10-point majority over reopeners. Reopeners are vocal and point to the lack of school spread of COVID-19 in districts that are open and have been open for some time. The problem is that it's very hard to isolate school spread from community spread outside of school. Even the CDC's guidance is based on expectations of viral behavior, not really good solid data on how COVID-19 spreads inside or does not spread inside of schools. Worth pointing out that COVID-19 is a novel virus and we should expect it to behave in unexpected ways. The community spread rate in Washington, D.C. metro area is down since November-December, but the UK, Brazilian, and South African variants of the virus have arrived in the region. In somewhat better news, the Washington Metro will receive the funding to maintain its service at nearly pre-pandemic level. What happens to Washington Metro will be an indicator of what happens to the region. The Metro is an incredibly complex, multi-jurisdictional political entity that really is an economic engine for the region. If you have news to share, email us at ihatepoliticspodcast@gmail.com or find us on Twitter at IH8PoliticsPod. I'll be right back with our guests. So Pratap, let me start with you. Help us locate Forest Glen and Montgomery Hills. Where is it? What does it look like? What's the history of the area?
Sure, absolutely. Well, Forest Glen and Montgomery Hills, so if you look at the diamond of DC and the tip of it, that right where Northwest hits Montgomery County, the Montgomery Hills, Forest Glen area starts at 16th Street and makes its way just past the Beltway. And it's an interesting area because over the years, you know, it has evolved mostly because of transportation changes, but it goes back to well in the 1600s, where there was a large land grant by Daniel Carroll, who was actually one of our founding fathers. And his son, John Carroll, ended up founding Georgetown University. And he's actually buried in the historic Forest Glen Cemetery right there off of Forest Glen Road.
Interesting.
But it really started at a time where people were escaping DC because it was so hot. You know, DC was a swamp for many, many years before some of the land reclamation started to happen. So people would go up north to escape the heat. And so you had one of the first premier hotels, the Ye Forest Inn, where people would come in. And these were often very, you know, dignitaries and important VIPs who would stay in these hotels. Hotel, unfortunately, didn't do so well. And over time, it turned into a girls' finishing school, which became a place where prominent families would send their daughters to learn how to host dinner parties or how to keep up appearances. And that was a time where these things were considered a skill set that every important family should, you know, their daughter should have, so to speak.
So hold on a minute. Now we are in the 20th century now, early 20th century?
Yeah. So at this point, we've jumped to the 1800s, early 1900s, and the space was evolving. And today, even if you go to the historic part of Forest Glen National Park Seminary, you'll see an incredible array of eclectic buildings, everything from a Japanese pagoda to Greek Revival buildings, a gymnasium that has since been converted to a historic kind of condominiums. And so that whole area was really interesting.
That's very interesting. Thank you. I want to bring in Melissa and ask you, since this is a really transportation heavy redesign, could you highlight the big road safety features that you would like to see most?
Well, you know, the interesting thing is we had two phases of improvements that we wanted to see happen on Georgia Avenue. So in the short term, what we were thinking about were narrowing the travel lanes so that we could actually get a protected median in. We wanted, additionally, we wanted to provide better access for pedestrians, because right now, in some places, protected crossings could be as far apart as 3,000 square feet, which is about a 15-minute walk. So that means that you essentially have Georgia Avenue is a barrier for a lot of people. They have to drive because it's not a very comfortable place to move about, either on, you know, cycling or walking. We also wanted to make sure that we had some green infrastructure in place to make it more attractive. And a lot of it is just slowing the speed down. I mean, you know, right now what we have is this kind of thoroughfare that's getting people through the community. They're not necessarily stopping, they're not slowing down. And so we're looking at Vision Zero opportunities there to kind of slow the traffic down, mitigate some of that friction. And that's in the short term. In the long term, what we're really looking at is a wholesale redesign. We're looking for more of a boulevard feel. We're looking at ways to widen the sidewalks, put in additional crossings, put in bike lanes, something that, you know, right now the idea of someone cycling down Georgia Avenue is, it's risky. It's, you know, people do it, they do it, you know, and I'm always amazed when I see it, because I'm thinking, you know, that's someone with really good life insurance probably, because it's a very risky proposition. But in the future, we're hoping that we're going to have bike lanes put into place. And then we're also looking at tackling that Beltway interchange. I mean, that's a huge deal, is making sure that we can make that not only safer, but actually make it make sense in the future.
How do people cross the 495 ramps in your plan?
Right now, so we have a bridge on one side. So, you know, there's a pedestrian bridge that was put into place not very long ago, which solved the problem of getting people across the bridge, but it's only on one side. So essentially you have to cross the street in order to actually use that bridge, or you essentially cross at grade, which means that you're crossing across that ramp where people are making a blind right turn in some cases. And so it's not something that we would encourage, which was the entire point of putting the bridge in, but you're still asking people to get across seven lanes of traffic in order to get to that bridge.
Right.
And if it's helpful, Sunil, I can give you a quick, I was going to give you a quick how we got to the pedestrian bridge, if that was helpful.
Yeah. Sure.
Just real quick. So just to finish real quick, the history lesson, basically as the community grew, you had World War II happen. The finishing school turned into a Walter Reed kind of hospital annex. And so as these communities started to grow, the functionality changed. You had suburban growth. You had post-World War II housing. Then, of course, you had the advent of the Beltway. And that's where what Melissa is referring to with what we're hoping to see happen with Georgia Avenue. The Beltway separated the north and the south side of what was once one community. And as a result, the problems we're having are a reflection of that. The metro was actually supposed to go on the south side off of Seminary Place. But the community at that time fought it because they were worried about what kind of people would actually come into their neighborhoods using the metro. And so it was pushed forward towards the north side, and which ended up being an incredible feat, because it's the deepest metro in the entire WMATA system. It's almost 200 feet below sea level, and it's one of the deepest metro stations in the world. And And if you look at the pictures of when it was constructed, it's kind of incredible to see how they put this together. And so as the area grew, there were even talks of the CIA moving to Forest Glen. If you look at the legislative history, it was one of the finalists for the sites where the current Walter Reed medical annex is. Mm-hmm. But that didn't happen. Once again, the community didn't want any kind of intelligence agency. So we ended up getting a lab that actually studies biochemical warfare and houses about 2,000 employees. So you have a major laboratory, you have a regional hospital that grew, which is Holy Cross Medical Center, which has since seen an expansion. Right at the Beltway, you have a metro, you have the Army Annex, and then you had the strip of Georgia Avenue, which became the commercial retail, because many of the communities in Chevy Chase, Maryland, didn't want to actually have retail in their neighborhoods. So they wanted to put it off on Georgia Avenue. And that's where Georgia Avenue had the wider lanes to accommodate trucks. If you go on Connecticut Avenue today, you'll notice that the lanes are much narrower because they didn't want those kind of vehicles in their neighborhoods. So in reflection, you know, Silver Spring became this hub of activity. But then when you had the Beltway there, all of a sudden, how do you cross it? And so what Melissa is referring to, the pedestrian bridge, the community came together, I believe, in 2007. And then the bridge was completed. Michelle, was it in 2000? Yeah, it was 2007, 2008. Is that correct?
Yeah. I mean, really what this neighborhood shows, though, was kind of the wayward transportation policies that we had for so long, right? When all we really thought about was how do we move the most cars and the most traffic through as fast as possible? And if you look at the Montgomery Hills Shopping Center, that was originally built for the neighborhood. It right. faces the neighborhood. It actually doesn't even face Georgia Avenue. It was intended to be a community center. There was originally a Baker and other kind of community shops. But then I think over the years, with the dominance of Georgia Avenue being a state highway and the state, unfortunately, transportation policies, everything focused on how do you get more cars as fast as possible and as many cars as possible from downtown DC, downtown Silver Spring, or even Wheaton onto the Beltway or off the Beltway into DC. And so everything kind of got forgotten about except for moving big volumes of cars. And that's really what created the landscape. I think that's there now.
Right. So, I mean, the interstates really did divide communities starting when they were built. And so you're kind of reclaiming for the community space that used to exist prior to interstate. But the interstates are going to stay. I mean, they're not going away. So it really is a challenge how you do this. And how did you sort of tackle that challenge? How did you how did you bring that forward? Michelle, you wanted?
Well, and it's interesting because that's exactly how, in my mind, it really solidified that it was something I had to work on. You know, I have two sons. One is 24 and one is 14 years younger. And with my first son, we went through, you know, this. I live on the east side of Georgia Avenue. The elementary school is on the west side of Georgia Avenue. So I spent all of his childhood driving him across Georgia Avenue to his friend's house, to the elementary school, right. Not being able to walk. Right. And when my younger son was born, I really wanted to kind of get away from having to be so car dependent. And so I started walking more with him. And it was really a challenge. And 14 years later, I found myself in the exact same position of having to get back in the car, driving him across Georgia Avenue, go to elementary school and going to his friend's house. And, you know, I'm a planner by training. I've worked as a planner for New York City and for the National Capital Planning Commission. I believe in the planning process.
Right.
So when the State Highway Administration first started looking at how to make Georgia Avenue more pedestrian friendly and make it more walkable, more bikeable. I really believed in the process, right? And to their credit, they came up with a full range of designs that were really interesting, really thought-provoking. And the community really coalesced around one of the designs, the ones that were actually settled on today, really supportive of that. And that doesn't always happen. I mean, Melissa and Pratap can both talk about that. It's not common that planners work on things that the community completely loves. And in this case, the community did. They loved it. and then nothing happened, right? So to your point earlier about Goldberg's bagels, here's one Sunday morning, I'm dragging my three-year-old across Georgia Avenue at like 8 a.m. on Sunday, right, and no traffic, and there's this horrific car accident. And that was it, right? So we were back in the car and I realized that I had to do something. I had to do whatever I could to try to see what I could do to help make the plan finally go forward and have some action. And really that was how I found Pratap, right? I knew that this was something that as many people as possible had to work on. When you work on advocacy and you're trying to promote something, you have to get as many people in the community. Pratap was already working on this issue in Forest Glen. And I was able to read the stuff that he had done through the blog. And then through Dan Reed, another planner who's been active in the community, I asked Dan to make an introduction to Pratap. I said, I have to meet Pratap and see how we can work together. And that was the introduction to how we started working together on this.
That's great. And this is how Friends of Forest Glen was born?
Yeah. So what's strange and what's cool about the friendship I have with Michelle, and I just thought about this, Michelle, but it's symbolic of, you know, in Montgomery County, we're so much into our communities and where we live in the neighborhoods, but I'm north of the Beltway. Michelle is south of the Beltway, but her planning background and my activism background, we saw each other as interconnected, whereas a lot of other community members never made that connection because they thought of Forest Glen as just, oh, well, that's north of the Beltway, that they have a metro station. We're south of the Beltway. We're a different community. But Michelle and I recognized very early on that we are in fact one community despite the Beltway. And so my activism helped us get, so I started the blog Finding Forest Glen, which turned into, was a reaction to me being kicked out of my civic association, which Melissa can attest to because she was actually at one of our very early meetings that were quite contentious. And I started my own virtual setting because I felt like there was a need for a new kind of format where people could engage online. And so after doing that, I started doing surveys. I started having random meetings. And my first meeting that I threw, I ordered pizza for everybody. 75 people showed up on a random Tuesday afternoon, Tuesday evening in August, in the time where most people are on vacation. And I thought, something is going on here. There's the appetite for change in this neighborhood. And so after doing that, I started Friends of Forest Glen, which was, you know, kind of an activism group. And we procured this new metro entrance on the east side, had a lot of success. And that's when Michelle contacted me and I said, well, let's change this to Friends of Forest Glen and Montgomery Hills. Why are we separated like this? You know, Montgomery Hills is, we're all the same. We're all part of the same area, this just Georgia Avenue corridor. And so we did that. And I really pushed at the same time, the planning department at the time, I was not commissioner, that, hey, let's get this master plan started. And they had already decided very early on that they were going to combine the two communities. And so we were kind of just following their lead. And next thing you know it, Michelle is, you know, having these incredible meetings with state delegates and we're engaging people. And then what can only be described as a historic street festival where through Michelle and some of the other activists, they ended up throwing an event where 700 people showed up, and it was actually during an election year. So I think, Michelle, we must have had every single county council member, candidate, county executive candidate. It was incredible.
I will add just to what Pratap said, you know, was one of the problems that had been over the years is that the commercial area, Georgia Avenue, wasn't represented by any of the associations. Right, so you have all these separate civic associations that are the residential areas, and they had their own, you know, there was the two that are on my side of Georgia Avenue, there was Forest Glen up by Pratap, there was Forest Estates on the other side, you know, Northwood side, and so they're kind of doing their own thing, but nobody was coming together to talk about this area and trying to come up with a just comprehensive vision for it. And I think that's what I saw when I saw the work Pratap was doing is I believed in the things he wanted to accomplish, the objectives that he had. And I realized there were other people in Northwood side that also felt the same way and that they could help. And so that was really useful to be able to kind of coalesce around this vision for a bigger area rather than being in these little separate silos of kind of neighborhood associations.
So were you able to put together sort of a omnibus group with all these four groups, or did you, and how did you work together? Because civic associations, as you know, are hard to work together with.
We did, right? So we put this core group together, starting with Pratap, myself representing the east side. Right. We got people from the south of the Beltway, west side of Georgia Avenue, so that we were representing all of the different neighborhoods. We worked in collaboration with the civic associations, but outside of that structure, so that we could have a broader scope. And I think that helped us be more successful because we weren't so insular and bound by those kind of artificial boundaries that they have to worry about.
Right. This is a very interesting point, actually, that you have to create some structures, new structures, in order to be able to get new policy in place. That's a very insightful comment that you made, Michelle. Thank you very much. Okay, so now we have a design. We have the good news that, you know, the Maryland Department of Transportation is going to pay to complete the design work. It's not that much money, but, you know, it is a big, big first step, right? So what should we expect? What are the next steps? Where are we going from here?
So I believe that there's a roughly a two-year design process. And as you mentioned, Sunil, that's correct, that SHA is going to fund the entire design and engineering. That'll take for 2 years. And then during that process, as that engineering is happening, as that design process is happening, presumably we will continue to work to make sure that we can secure construction funding. That's a much bigger pot of money. It'll be a little bit more of a challenge to be able to secure, but that will be what we need to make the next step towards completion of the plan.
So let me ask, so we have a sector plan in place, right? So we have an approved sector plan. Is SHA, Maryland Department of Transportation, bound by the sector plan? I mean, is it, or is it just an advisory? How does that work?
What I will say is that we make recommendations. And I think it is, like, the long and the short of it is it's recommended. It's strongly recommended. What ends up happening is they have to come back to us with a mandatory referral. Okay. And that is essentially, it's an interesting process. What I will say is that a mandatory referral comes in for approval, but they can still move forward even if they don't get the approval. It's helpful for them to present something to our planning board that they can sign off on, but it does not prevent them from moving forward. What I will say is that having a sector plan that has recommendations and having a development that you're proposing or having an infrastructure improvement that is recommended in the plan makes it a lot easier. It makes the process definitely more efficient. And so right now, I think we are fortunate to be in a position where I think all parties are kind of on the same page. And we've been kind of lockstep for a long time. And, you know, as Michelle said, you know, that does not normally happen. You know, we have not always had the type of relationship that we have with SHA currently. So we are, you know, incredibly pleased that right now, from the planning department's perspective or from the perspective of the sector plan, we're pleased that it appears that we are headed in the direction that everyone agreed to and what was approved, what was that, last year? What was finally approved last year?
Correct. August.
I agree. I agree with you, Melissa. And just to give you some more background, Sunil, the good news is, having done a sector plan, a master plan, it's in the state's best interest in terms of making this corridor a successful corridor to follow that what the Parking Planning Commission has approved and the County Council has also approved. And so they've recognized that even when it comes to the permitting process, there is going to be an intersectionality between SHA, MDOT, MCDOT, Montgomery County Department of Transportation. Right. And they want to see a successful kind of corridor. So this plan is really cool because it includes missing middle housing, It includes significant density both at the metro station on both sides of the West and East Georgia Avenue, and even significant density in Montgomery Hills, more than we would have ever imagined. And simultaneously, the planning board and the county council in the growth policy also designate this entire area as a red policy zone. So impact taxes for the entire area will be waived.
Is that the only implication of a red policy zone, or is there are there any other implication of having a red policy zone?
So the red policy zone in general, and you can correct me, Melissa, but my understanding is you have to pay, when it comes to development, there's a really defined chart that basically explains, based on the number of units, how much impact taxes are you paying? And impact taxes, just so you know, are fees that developers have to pay that go to fund both transportation costs as well as schools. So it's usually two buckets. And so a red policy zone is the highest designation you can give an area that basically significantly cuts down the amount of fees, the impact taxes that you would have to pay in order to develop a site. And so for sites in Forest Glen and Montgomery Hills, sometimes what happens is they become cost prohibitive because by the time you run the numbers, the taxes that you have to pay on a property, they become very, it becomes very difficult to develop. And there's also a recognition that, especially on the transportation side, if you're doing infill development that's near public transportation that already has some critical infrastructure in place, like a metro station or tunnel, or even in this case, a pedestrian bridge, the impact on transportation, especially if it's going to be transit-oriented development, and we're actually saying now transit-oriented communities. So we're trying to let people know that these are actually communities, not just development. There's less of an impact on the traditional transportation like vehicle usage that hopefully people are going to be walking and using the metro.
So that's great. SHA, the State Highway Administration, the Montgomery County Planning Department, the activists involved are, you know, all in agreement. But it seems like that the State Highway Administration still has some leeway in what it does and how it does. So where do you see advocacy going forward, and how do you organize?
So, I mean, I'll say for the most part, I think SHA has been really well aligned with the goals and the objectives, both of what the planning department has wanted to see and the community. And, you know, perhaps that is fairly unusual. Their main mission is to move cars and to build highways. But from the beginning, I feel like they really did embrace the goals of walkability and bikeability. The big issue has really always been, where's the money going to come from? And does this plan rise to the level of priority that they would put the funding toward it over other transportation projects that are more conventional, like Beltway expansion, right? So right. That's really where the advocacy has had to be. It's not been so much to convince them to do a different plan.
Okay.
It's been to fund this, given that there's just way more plans around the whole state and even the county than there is resources.
Right. And what is your expectation about that? Do you think that the state will find the money, you know, in the 2-year framework, 5-year framework that I think it seems reasonable?
So I feel like Secretary Slater has been true to his word. He has said this is a priority for him. And while we hadn't seen the funding come through for sure, he has promised that we have it. So I feel confident that he'll come through the funding. I have no reason to believe that it won't, right? The construction funding is a bigger chunk of funding, and that's going to be a challenge. Again, we're one of many, many projects in the state that'll be competing for funding, but I'm hopeful that the state will work with the county and that the county will support this as well. And that perhaps we'll even be able to get some federal funding with the new Biden administration. I think there'll be some increased support and visibility for projects like this that encourage walkability, transit use, bikeability, right? It'll fit right in the sweet spot, I think, of a lot of the goals and objectives of the new administration. And so perhaps we can see some US DOT funding come for this project as well. And that would be the trifecta, right? To get some county, some state, and some federal funding so that we can finally move forward. And we've always said the road improvements are the linchpin for the sector plan. Right. So we have to, you know, we want to see the sector plan come to fruition. We want to see those plans be able to be put into place, but we have to fix the road first before all the other pieces can fall into place.
Right. I mean, that's would be great if we could get some infrastructure funding for the, you know, from the federal government. So I think going forward, we have to planning is an interesting kind of activity, right? There's a design process, and yet the planning department doesn't actually bring anything about. I mean, it recommends, and so much of what's going to happen depends on whether different levels of government put forward that money and what local private landowners do, right? So Pratap, I think in terms of the private-public partnership that is sort of inherent in the planning process, with respect to this plan, what are the things that you know that you're hoping for, that you will see? Mm-hmm. What kind of big projects are you looking at?
Well, one of the things we did during the planning process, and Melissa was integral in this process, was talking to the owners of properties to see what are their kind of future plans and what would they like to see happen. So that's one component. And then, of course, the other component is also, well, what do we do with public land, land that is owned by the government? And in this case, we have an 8-acre parcel right at the Forest Glen Metro, which we ended up upzoning to 120-foot tall potential of mixed-use housing, mixed-use development, and community amenities and open space. And then that was also done across the street, which is owned by a private entity. So this was a great project because we were able to look at each parcel, do some micro planning, looking at what's the best way of creating a vision for a walkable and robust environment. One of the challenges we have is, and we're seeing this in the pandemic, is that in order to have the amenities that we would like, you need the density. And in order to ensure that Metro is a successful way of getting into the city or other areas, you need people to live there and fraternize it via ridership. So these are all things that the plan allows for. And I believe if everything were to be built up, we would have right around 6,500 new units in this entire section, which is incredible given the constraints that we've had for so many years. And all of these proposed developments would be even as far as where Michelle lives and where I live, you're talking about anywhere between a 2-minute to a 10 to 15 minute walk to the Metro. And that's not bad at all.
No,
just the fact that you could walk, and then not to mention stop at a coffee shop, stop at a grocery store, you know? And so these are things that this area has incredible bones. And what's always been amazing about Montgomery Hills and Forest Glen is that the commercial side is not very flattering, right? It doesn't have a lot of trees. The signage is not consistent. There's about 6 gas stations. It's very not your traditional kind of main street. But the minute you get off of the commercial areas, the neighborhoods are absolutely beautiful.
Right.
They are stunning, and they're amongst the most desirable neighborhoods in this area. 20910 is a very, especially these days, it's a very competitive real estate market. But the commercial strip doesn't reflect that. And so we're hoping with this plan that by providing the zoning, and you've said you've kind of like hit the nail on the head, that we only plan, but in the end of the day, we're hopefully setting it up, teeing it up, so the private sector can come in, or in this case, even the public sector can come in and say, okay, we're confident that something can happen here. But in order for that to happen, it's incredible what activists like Michelle have done, because not only have they changed the conversation in terms of what can happen here, but they're setting it up in a way where if it wasn't for these kind of interactions with public officials, you probably would not see any change. And remember, the Montgomery Hills, at least the Georgia Avenue plan, Michelle, I believe, has been on the books for at least 50 years. And nothing ever happened. And it's always been a joke, because it's like, how many generations have to go by and say, oh yeah, Georgia Avenue was supposed to get redesigned. And if you go through the history, there've been so many redesigns. It's been incredible.
Well, I will be watching very, very closely what happens. And I wish you all the luck. I hope you get the funding. I hope the southern end of Georgia Avenue really blossoms into another downtown Silver Spring. I'm going to ask one last question, perhaps, of Michelle, and say, if you were giving advice to somebody else in around the county about how to organize, how to sort of persuade government to do this, what is the advice that you would give them?
I think the best advice I would give them is you have to find who else you're going to work with, right? Nothing gets accomplished by a team of one. And I think the way to be able to get anybody's attention is to show that it's a shared vision of many people. So you have to find that crew of yours that believe in that vision, that have the same goals and objectives, and just start talking about it and get people excited about it. People don't know where to start sometimes, right? You know, I mean, the planning department is great. They provide so many different venues for public hearings and be able to get involved, but it can be very intimidating to the average person, right? They're not sure how to plug in, or they maybe go and they listen. And sometimes it just is a matter of, you know, the way we started is just calling up a couple of friends or people who you think have a similar goal, getting together and having a cup of coffee like we did and a couple of bagels, and then do it every other Friday. And just believe that you can effectuate change. You don't have to be an elected official or anybody really important. You just have to have a group of people with that shared vision. That's what I would suggest to anybody who wants to get started.
Find your crew and believe in yourself. Well, thank you, Melissa Williams, Michelle Foster, and Pratap Verma. This has been great.
Thank you very much.
We'll be right back. $1.6 million is not that much money in the world of government spending today. But the Maryland Department of Transportation's decision to allocate that money to complete a redesign of the streetscape in the lower section of Georgia Avenue, intersecting the Capitol Beltway in Montgomery County, is a big deal. It is a big deal because if, like me, you like walking, that section of Georgia Avenue is a nightmare. Indeed, Georgia Avenue corridor remains one of the most dangerous roads in Montgomery County. It is also a big deal because of the history and what it means for the future. You heard Michelle Foster say, with the State Highway Administration, which manages Georgia Avenue, knew, accepted, and agreed with activists on what needed to be done. The issue, as always, was where to find the money. So finally, that money is slowly trickling in. As Michelle also pointed out, it took years of organizing and advocacy. If you want to see some change in your community, you should find your crew. Who else is thinking like you? Today, it is easy to do, go online. Pratap Verma became fed up with the existing neighborhood association and started a blog, which caught the eye of Michelle Foster. They are coming together as a team, brought together two sides of Georgia Avenue, Forest Glen to the north of the Beltway and Montgomery Hills to the south of the Beltway. Later, they were joined by other neighborhoods. Once the ball starts to roll, to use a snowy metaphor, it snowballs. But even when you start online, you must move on to in-person relationships. There is no replacing that. And Pratap and Michelle coordinate closely offline. The second lesson I would draw is that the work of advocacy on behalf of communities around Georgia Avenue has not ended. Maryland Department of Transportation is going to look at redesigning the streetscape, but the sector plan from the Montgomery County Planning Department, which is approved by the County Council, is a recommendation. Maryland DOT could accept some of the changes, reject others, and even offer their own. Michelle and Pratap will have to be working on that in the future. The construction money will be many times more than the $1.6 million in design money that has been allocated, but at least they are in the process that is designed to generate a consensus that can be brought forward for approval. This is the political process. Lastly, participating in the political process leads to power. Pratap Verma today serves as a commissioner on the Montgomery County Planning Board, a statutory authority that manages development in the county. My thanks to Melissa Williams, Michelle Foster, and Pratap Verma. We end with a segment called Things I Could Do But Probably Won't. And just to say this at the top, I have three kids, a dog, and a mom to care for. So I read and hear about some really cool and fun things to do, but mostly I'm stuck cooking dinner. Here's to hoping your schedule is lighter. At the Brookside Nature Center in Montgomery County, you can take a self-guided maple trail tour to learn about the history and science of maple sugaring. The tour is available from sunrise to sunset. On Saturdays and Sundays, a naturalist is at the Evaporator Pan at a building called the Harper Cabin and can explain how sap turns into syrup, completely free. On Saturday, February 6th, between 12 and 2 p.m., local historian John Muller leads a walk through old Anacostia telling stories of Ward 8's famous resident Frederick Douglass, exploring 19th century architecture and neighborhood folklore. This one costs money, $20, and meets at the Frederick Douglass National Historical Site. Also on Sunday, February 6th, between 6 and 7:30 p.m., on Facebook, there's a virtual guided tour of Taj Mahal. In a different time, I used to go there and sit at the Taj Mahal all day long reading books. Thursday, February 11th, at 7 p.m., Lauren Markham, author of The Faraway Brothers, and a panel of local Latino leaders and educators and students, by the way, will talk about the challenges to the Latino community and how we can mitigate those challenges. I have to end with a plug for a walk in Rock Creek Park and its connected green spaces, an incredible island of peace that is really close to home. See you next time on I Hate Politics podcast. I hope you'll subscribe and share the podcast as we bring you stories about politics close to you and your home. Bye-bye.